We're not going to take it anymore. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And as always, Barry, it's great to be with you. This is a nice Saturday day to be listening to the radio. So hopefully the folks out there will put up with us for an hour as we bloviate on things that are going on along. And hopefully we can impress them with our worldview, our Christian worldview, as it relates to some of the issues that we're dealing with.
And if we can't, it's an hour that you're not listening to sports. So be that as it may.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, Chuck, we've spent a lot of time, and it's, you know, because it's important to talk, especially from a biblical perspective and a constitutional perspective, about what's happening in our country. And obviously everything was focused in on up to this last week on the election for president. And now that that's done and we've seen the outcome, and whether you believe the outcome to be legitimate or a result of massive voter fraud with 108% turnout in some states and some precincts, the point is that there's been a lot of, Chuck, I guess the best way to say it is hand-wringing, and I think panic mindset that has set in among many evangelicals and conservatives and those who would otherwise consider themselves to probably be fine, upstanding people. You and I have seen it through our personal contacts with many of our friends and associates. Everything from the fact that this is the, you know, the end of the age and biblical prophecy is about to come true, which it already has, to the end of, well, we just have to, you know, go and do it again next time and see what else, see what new results we can get out of doing the same thing all over again.
Well, you see hand-wringing and, you know, fear and that kind of thing. I see anger. There's a lot of deep-seated anger, and I'm not completely sure, but near as I can tell, people are angry that not enough people came out and voted for their chosen anointed one, Romney, to save them from the Simon Legree Barack Obama. And the fact is that, you know, it's sort of like asking Stalin to come save you from Hitler. It's six of one, half dozen of another. And as a number of people in occupied territory during the war, you know, that there was something of a turnout like that. There were a number of partisans that came out when the Nazis occupied places like the Ukraine and got together with Hitler because they were throwing off the yoke of Stalin, only to find out that they were putting the yoke of Hitler on. And it turned out that basically it was sort of like falling from the frying pan into the fire. It didn't really matter who was in charge. It was just as bad either way. And that's exactly what we've been saying all along, that this anger and complete being out of your being because Mitt Romney didn't win. Well, okay, you dodged one bullet and got hit by another one. Does it really matter if the gun was fired by a Democrat or a Republican?
No,
I don't think
the results are pretty much the same.
Yeah, the tissue damage and the possible death are the same thing. I'm not saying we're going to die because Barack Obama got reelected. Please don't try to put that word in my mouth. It's a metaphor, folks.
And
if you don't know what a metaphor is, you know, we'll do another show on that some other day on what a metaphor is. But the fact is that there's just a lot of very deep and seething emotion out there. And it's a mix of things, anger, resentment, disappointment, name some negative emotion, and it's probably out there floating around, despair for another thing. And it's all culminating in people not thinking very clearly. And that's what we're beginning to see. Now, I hope that people sort of snap out of it and start to do a little critical analysis. You know, we've tried to keep our cool and do critical analysis for the whole election cycle. And I think we've done a pretty good job because, well, we haven't had, take it from the perspective that God is in control. We have people that we were supporting for certain offices and other people that we had no people to support in other offices. And we said, okay, God's in control. Whoever ends up in control is the person that God wants to be there for whatever reason. Now, and very often, as we know from Scripture, you get the leadership that you deserve. As we know from 1 Samuel 8, the whole section on the judges being rejected, in other words, really, the judges were a Republican form of government, and it was really largely a self-government with God at the head. And God comes out in 1 Samuel 8 and says, they are not rejecting you, as he talks to Samuel. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me as their king. And they're asking for a king. Well, they're going to get their king. And when they get their king, they're not going to like what they get. In other words, God was saying, I'm going to give them the leader they deserve. And who was the leader that came out of that?
That would be Saul.
It was Saul. How well did Saul work out as a king?
Well, fantastically, if you were Saul.
Well,
at least in his eyes. But if you were anybody else around him, not so much.
Yeah, Saul desperately wanted to be a good leader, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. And in fact, he found himself in situations where he attempted to usurp offices held by other men because they weren't doing it on his timing. And after all, he was the king. So this is what's happened, Barry. People have sort of taken on this, Lord, give us a king attitude, and when the king that they want doesn't end up being the guy, then they have an emotional reaction to that. And that's exactly what's happened here, at least from my perspective. And we're beginning to see really silly, not well thought out things coming to the forefront. Well, I'm hoping by talking about this today, we sort of maybe put the brakes on those kind of brainless exercises, or at least help put the brakes on those brainless exercises.
Oh, at the very least, we can shed a little light on the one of them, at least, which has been growing in popularity by leaps and bounds since it first appeared about a week ago, about 2 days after the November elections were finished on the 6th, about the 8th, I believe. Was when this new approach, which isn't really a new approach, it's an old approach, but the way it's being handled is definitely not traditional, let's put it that way. Many of our listeners may have heard of this already, and some of you may have put your name to these petitions, but there has been a slew of petitioning, Chuck, to the White House, to President Barack Obama, calling for or asking for a review, I suppose, by the White House of the petitioner's request to have their state secede from the Union. Yes, that's right, folks. It is 2012, not 1859. But yes, there is a movie about Lincoln coming out, and so maybe this is timely. I just now thought that. But the point is that we have, this has grown by leaps and bounds. At first, it was a handful of states, I think five or six, where some citizens in the state, the White House itself has set up on its website a section called We the People. It's an online petitioning system. And according to the White House rules of operation for this, that anytime somebody puts a petition up there that receives 25,000 or more signatures, then the administration promises to review the request and respond appropriately. Well, as of the middle, we're taping this midweek for today's program. So as of Wednesday of this week, there were more than 675,000 signatures that have been submitted on petitions 69 separate petitions that have been submitted to the White House covering all 50 states. So that's right. There are people in every one of the states of the union, and I'm sure that there are probably some in Puerto Rico who just voted to not join the United States in their referendum, who do not want to be a part of an Obama America. That's really not a surprise, Chuck. But the point is that as you and I have looked at this over the week, and we've kicked this back and forth, and as this thing has grown and grown, and we've started seeing emails and excitement coming from the Tea Party and from social conservatives, all, you know, pointing to this as, oh, this is our only hope. This is the only thing we've got left. Well, Chuck, honestly, I think this dog's barking up the wrong tree.
Well, Barry, secession is a very, very, very serious step.
It is indeed.
It is not something to be bantered about and bandied about lightly. It is a last resort in a government gone completely haywire. There are several steps before this that are considered steps to eventual secession, but can very often be stopped short of secession. Now, what's gone on here is that somebody has come up with this lame brain scheme to use the We the People petitions that are on the web, the White House website. Now, one of the things that scares me about that is that one of the results that's supposed to come from these positions is quote unquote appropriate action. What has happened here is that 625,000 people up to this point have signed their name to something that says they want to do something that the government considers a giant no-no.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's sort of like, you know, they're signing their name to this thing and then, you know, doing what the old Jimmy Cagney thing, if you've ever seen White Heat, the movie, where Jimmy Cagney's this bad guy who's a little crazy, standing on top of the burning oil refinery saying, "Come and get me, screw." Well, what people think they're doing is daring the feds to come get them. Well, first of all, that's not the way this works. Normally what it does is it just gets your emails looked at and your phone calls listened to, and maybe the FBI might come out and dig through your trash. And if they find something that makes you a little more interesting, then you get some serious surveillance. But the fact is, all you've done is basically put your name on a list, and you are now going to be looked at very seriously as a potential threat.
Well, let's unpack that just a little bit, Chuck, because we know that many folks whom we know and, you know, feel are good, well-meaning conservatives and constitutionalists have passed around the email saying, please put your name on this petition. Well, honestly, first of all, Chuck, the White House set this up so that they could vet various ideas, mainly from liberal groups, so that they could kick it out there and say that they had public support for it when they put it forward as a policy proposal. The idea that the incoming and the existing Obama administration would in any way, shape, or form take seriously the idea of allowing states to secede from the United States under their watch, I should have been the first thought that came to many of these people's minds before they put pen to paper and signed their name and their information on these petitions. This would have no good purpose to be served for Obama, because if you know from the election, in many states, Barack Obama won the popular vote. And so why allow a state to secede from the union, like California, because we did say all 50 states have for these petitions, when you're going to get massive numbers of votes as a liberal Democrat from these states? And even so, in states like Ohio, which are considered swing states, why would you want Ohio to secede from the union when Ohio ends up being the cornerstone of how you win the presidency? These things didn't cross a lot of people's minds, and they put their names on these petitions, which go to the White House, okay? Now, you had mentioned earlier about there, you know, there's a long string of abuses that take place before you get to the what would be considered a very final step of secession from the Union. And many people could point to some of the existing issues we have in this country. We have the Patriot Act. We have the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows for U.S. citizens to be arrested, even in their own homes, by military and held without trial. Hasn't happened to any great extent just yet, but yeah, I'm thinking, Chuck, that possibly there might be 675,000 potential people on a list who would be considered a possible threat to the security and safety of the country because they want to pull their state out and secede. They may have a legitimate grief, they may have a legitimate argument, but they're not really using a legitimate process because at the very last place you would go to petition to secede from the Union is the White House, is the executive branch of government, because honestly, Chuck, they don't have any skin in the game.
They don't.
First and foremost, if these petitions were going to be legitimate and serious, they should be filed with each state's own legislature. Because it would be the state legislature and then the governor of the state who would then make the call or make a formal petition to Congress in relation to this, their state removing itself from the federal union. And as we know, in Texas, where I think Texas has the largest number of signers on these petitions at over 100,000 signers. Well, back a couple, 3 years ago, their governor, Rick Perry, was talking up the potential of secession. Well, funny how things have changed since he ran in the Republican primary for president and was not successful. And now that a number in his state, now 100,000 in Texas really isn't the, you know, a large majority of the people of Texas, obviously. But that Rick Perry already said through a spokesperson that he doesn't support the idea of secession for Texas. And in a quote, it says that Governor Perry believes in the greatness of our union and nothing should be done to change it. But he also shares the frustrations many Americans have with our federal government. Okay, well, that's all fine and well, but just shows again that, you know, Rick Perry wasn't really serious about some of the things that he was saying. He was supporting the idea of Texas seceding back in 2009, but now that it's looking like it's more serious option to some people, he's backing away from it as fast as he possibly can.
Well, you know, Barry, there's a little sequence that goes on. If you've ever seen the movie Christmas Story, where the little kids are out on the playground and they're going through the whole rigmarole, and they talk about the etiquette of the dares. There's the dare you, the double dare, the double dog dare, the triple dog dare, or the triple dare you, and then the triple dog dare. Well, Schwartz created a slight breach of etiquette by skipping over the double dare you and the double dog dare and skipping right over into the triple dog dare.
Yes.
Well, what has gone on here? Let's talk about the mechanics of how the entire secession mechanism is supposed to work. And actually, Thomas Jefferson has laid this out in some of his writings when he was discussing and creating the Virginia and Kentucky resolves.
Yes, indeed.
Madison, they went through the mechanics of what was supposed to happen. Basically, what happens is first, the citizens of a state petition for redress of grievances to the federal government.
Yes, which is guaranteed to the citizens of the state under the First Amendment to the Constitution.
Right. And they also petition for redress of grievances directly through their representatives in Congress and through their state legislators who were at that time in control of the U.S. senators. So the sequence was you complained both to your congressman and to your senator through the state legislature. That way the state legislature knew that there was a movement afoot in the state for this particular thing to happen. The next step after, for instance, the petition for redress of grievances was ignored by the federal government. And we saw this actually happen in the Tariff of Abominations.
Yes.
During the nullification crisis in the 30s. The next step is nullification. And what is supposed to happen in nullification is not well understood. But because it is not a movement of the state government per se, it is a movement of the people of the government, there are committees that are formed. There is a convention that is formed that basically tells the state government to pass a law nullifying the law inside that state. In other words, because a convention is a higher lawmaking body, and we have talked about this over and over and over again. If you want to know what we're talking about, look up on some of our shows that we've done on a constitutional convention, because we discussed this rather extensively. But a convention is a higher lawmaking body than a legislature. The convention orders the state government to nullify the law. And it's usually the state legislature is already, you know, pretty much okay with that, so that they usually don't see that as a problem. But in any case, then the nullification takes place, and basically what a nullification says is that law is unconstitutional and is null and void in this state. Now, how can they say it's unconstitutional? Isn't that the Supreme Court's job? Well, that's when the Supreme Court isn't doing its job. That's the entire point of nullification. That is why the states, the individual states, are the final authority on what the Constitution says, not the Supreme Court, because of the 10th Amendment. Because the right to nullify, the right to redress of grievances, to petition for redress of grievances, is a First Amendment right. The right to nullify is a 10th Amendment right. Now,
that's correct.
What happens after that? After that nullification, you've got another thing. Then the federal government may say, well, we're going to enforce it by force. We're going to send troops to enforce that, which, by the way, they can't do because of the Posse Comitatus Act. You basically can't send troops. And remember, the way the government was originally designed, the state militias were an army to protect the rights of the citizens. In other words, it was the citizens armed in order to protect their own rights from a usurper. Well, we don't have that system now. And maybe we need to think about going back to a militia system for that reason. It was dismantled after the Civil War when they saw what happened when the militias were called out to protect the states from an encroachment by the federal government. Okay, that being said, the next step after nullification is if the federal government continues to refuse to do something to redress the grievances of the people of that state, the people of that state then take their 10th Amendment rights and declare themselves out of the union. Since the union is a voluntary union, in other words, the members are in it because they want to be in it, then the next step is secession. So we're not going to put up with this. It's illegal here. You can't do it. And we no longer want to be part of any government that would do that. And we don't want any part of it. Then they can vote. They form a convention. Again, a higher lawmaking body than a legislature.
Absolutely.
And they decide, remember, that the Constitution had to be ratified by convention. And that is the reason. They couldn't simply be ratified by the state legislature. It had to be ratified by a convention, because a convention, as the direct representatives of the people, is a higher lawmaking body than a state legislature. Okay, so that's how you secede. You don't send a petition to the White House asking permission to leave. Because,
no.
Barry, all you have to do is examine history. And you can be fairly certain that the president is going to say no.
Well,
this is
he would absolutely be crazy if he said anything other than that.
Well, a real president who understood the Constitution would say, maybe you're right. We can't survive. You know, we can't get along together. Let's see how you do well on your own. Go and good luck. But we haven't had a president that has understood things like that since before Abraham Lincoln. In fact, Abraham Lincoln in 1860 had made the statement that if South Carolina seceded, there wasn't really a whole lot he could do about it.
Right.
And in fact, somebody in the money section in the Treasury came to him and said, do you understand what you're saying? Do you understand where about 60% of the federal revenue comes from? It comes from ports in the South, because the South imported a lot of goods because it was an agrarian economy. They didn't have a lot of manufacturing. Therefore, things had to be imported. And imports bring duties, and duties was what the federal government ran on at the time. So, you see how people have lost touch because they don't understand the Constitution, they don't understand the mechanics, they don't understand the thought that has gone into this for probably 40 years before the Civil War, if not longer. Because if you'll recall, Barry, what was the birth of the United States of America?
It was the secession movement. It was
That's right.
It was secession from the Articles of Confederation.
Even before that, yes. The 13 colonies seceded
from England.
From Britain. From Great Britain.
That's right.
We basically said, nope, thank you, and we did it that way. We went through the petition for redress of grievances. We went through nullification. If you recall, the Stamp Act, acts of assistance. There were any number of acts that simply were very openly the colonial legislature said, no, you can't do that here. And of course, the royally appointed governor said, oh, yes, they can.
Yes, they can. That's right.
The royal governors would disband the legislature, and the legislature would then go off and meet someplace else.
Exactly.
That kind of thing. Well, if you look at that, the fact is that the United States seceded from Great Britain in 1776. And then again, the 13 states seceded from the old Union under the Articles of Confederation and formed a new Union under the Constitution. So not only has, you know, secession has been done three times, twice successfully.
That's right.
Now, I would say that, believe it or not, I had this discussion with somebody on Facebook today, that in fact, the 1860 secession was also a success because the Union required them to go through a readmission procedure.
Yes, that's right.
To get back in.
That's right.
In other words, it's a tacit admission that legally they had seceded from the Union. And that the entire war between the states was fought in order to force them to come back into the Union. Now, does forcing someone into the Union mean it was legal because you won the war? Not when you admit that they had legally left. That means that I'm taking a leap here, and a lot of people are going to go, oh, how can you say that? The South seceded legally, and the North illegally forced them back into the Union by use of force. That's the bottom line. And that's why people are saying, well, don't you know anything about the Civil War? Yeah, I learned a lot about the Civil War. In fact, I'm aware that the original death toll was placed at about 625,000. Now they're talking more like 800,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the recent numbers have been rerun by some statistician. And the numbers are looking more like about 800,000, the vast majority of them killed in the South. If you watch Gone with the Wind, the only soldier that died in the war was a Northerner. And he was shot in the face by Scarlett O'Hara.
Well, that's definitely historical revisionism at that point.
Definitely. But that being said, we have a problem in that people don't know how serious a step this is, and they don't understand the history of it, and they don't understand the mechanics of it, and why it is legal to do it. But it is a very important step that should not be taken lightly, because some guy you don't like just got reelected to the presidency.
Well, absolutely. But Chuck, you know, let's talk about this, first of all, because you will have some who will look at you and say, well, I've looked at the Constitution and secession's not in there. You know, and honestly, they have a point. It's kind of a blunt point, but it's a point that it's specifically not spelled out how states are to secede from the Union in the Constitution. However, there is a clause in the Constitution that talks about how new states are formed. Article 4, Section 3, the first clause of that, says that new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress. So, Chuck, if many of these folks, and there have been different petitions throughout history, and even in the 20th and 21st centuries, petitions and movements to have parts of states secede, or, you know, to split California into two states, South California and North California, or to just divide Ohio and give Cleveland to Michigan, you know, something of that nature. But and I jest about that last
one. But then they'd have both Detroit and Cleveland. Why would they want that?
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason why it never seceded or succeeded either, yes. But the point is that if Article 4 sets up that a state, the process in order to form a new state is that the legislatures of the parts of the states where this new entity would be carved out, and folks think back to Kentucky, both Kentucky and West Virginia being formed out of Virginia, that's kind of the idea you're getting, that the process is the state legislative consent and then the Congress consents. There's nothing in this, and we would by inference extend that to say nothing in what would be considered a legitimate secession effort that involves the executive branch of the federal government in any way whatsoever. But because people are not as tuned into their Constitution as probably they should be, Charles, and we can remedy that by folks taking the Institute on the Constitution courses that we offer and provide in various places around the state of Ohio. And, you know, folks can go to our website at principalpolicy.com to check in on that and see where classes are being held all over the state. But if they learn more about the Constitution, they would learn that these type of online petitions that are put forth by the White House really are not a good idea. And as a matter of fact, there are some who think that it's such a bad idea. And I'm going to go to an article that you and I saw at theexaminer.com. This was written by David Kudrea on the 14th of November, and it's titled "Secession Fuhrer Could Pose Unintended Consequences for Gun Owners." And Mr. Kudrea goes through his article talking about this whole idea, about these petitions, and about this whole situation where, you know, basically many are recalling the Declaration of Independence, that the words of Thomas Jefferson, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government as a kind of a raison d'etre for the secession movements. But what we're getting down to is the fact that we've now handed the White House a list of people who don't agree with the president, who disagree so strongly that they want their entire state removed from the union to get out from under the tyranny that they see in the Obama administration and the destruction of the country that they foresee coming, that they put their pen to paper. Well, he says, now, you know, some people have said that there's a situation here because some people have filed a counter petition to some of these state petitions. And the counter petition, and I quote, says that ask the president to, quote, sign an executive order such that each American citizen who signed a petition from any state to secede from the USA shall have their citizenship stripped and be peacefully deported. Now, that went up, like I said, this article is written on the 14th. That petition went up online at the White House petition website, the We the People site, on the 12th, and it's already got 10,000 signatures. Now, like I said earlier in our program, the White House has said and stated clearly that when they reach a petition, if it can reach 25,000 signatures in 30 days, then the White House will then take it under advisement and discuss it within the administration as to what they're going to do. Now, you know, you and I laughed offline, Chuck. It's like, okay, you got 675,000 petitions on one side. You got 10 maybe going on 25,000 on the other. Which one in the Obama administration do you think is going to get more serious consideration? You know, okay, ladies and gentlemen, you don't even have to put down a bet on this one. It's going to be the one about stripping citizenship from people. And he says, now, if they do this, he says that here's the deal. If the disqualifying triggers in the U.S. code that if you lose your citizenship, then you're forbidden by federal law to own a gun. And so that many of these folks might find themselves in a real sticky situation by having their citizenship renounced and then having their right to have a firearm within the United States taken away from them. And he says that basically, you know, that it's really kind of a situation where you really need to think through these things a lot more carefully than obviously the furor and the fever of a petition that is expressing your deep, deep concern about the outcome of this election is showing. In other words, people haven't thought this through very well.
And that's kind of the whole point that I was making earlier, Barry.
That's right.
When you are steeped in a boiling vat of emotion, you're probably really not thinking too clearly. And that's been my point all along. The fact is that emotion has been at an absolute fever pitch since about the end of the primary season, you know, since May or June or so. And I mean, people have just been cranking out the emotion and the adrenaline. And when it all came down to the end and they lost, it's coming forth in an explosion of stupidity. Not that people are permanently stupid, but they certainly are not thinking very clearly on signing these petitions.
Well, and honestly, the situation is that they would be doing us all a bigger favor if they would focus on talking with their state legislators in regard to nullification of things like Obamacare. We're fighting that fight right now here in Ohio, Charles. Many in the liberty movement and even in the gun rights movements and in other places had raised some concerns earlier in the week that word had come to them that the Kasich administration was planning on filing a petition with the federal government to be allowed to start a Obamacare-style healthcare exchange in Ohio. And there was howling and moaning and groaning across the fruited plain about this. Well, they come to find out that maybe their information wasn't quite right, that the administration was not going to seek approval for an exchange, but rather they were just going to let the feds create an exchange and then probably at some point force Ohio into it. I'm not sure which is worse.
Well, Barry, you know, you and I talked about this because we got a call from our good friend Ricky Pepin.
Yes, we did.
Who's a fellow Institute on the Constitution teacher over in the Dayton area. And Ricky called me and asked me a question. I think it was about HJR, what was it, HJR 11? Was that
right?
In the last legislative session?
Yeah.
And what that was a very good bill that was a declaration of 10th Amendment sovereignty. and it had in it a mechanism to go into a nullification procedure should things not work out between the federal government and Ohio. Now, that would have been a great resolution. Of course, it's a resolution that doesn't really carry the force of law. But what it is a declaration of the legislature to say this is what we're going to do if you do this. Now, what that would have gone hand in hand in very nicely was the Health Freedom Amendment that Ohio passed that amended its constitution that does not allow the governor or the state legislature to make arrangements with the federal government to create those exchanges. What people don't understand, or maybe some of them do, I think a lot of them do because they voted for it, was they outlawed the making the arrangements to get Obamacare rolling in the state of Ohio. It's not legal here by our Constitution.
Well, that brings up an entirely new issue, Chuck. You're right that by our Constitution, because in 2010, the voters went to the polls and they passed a constitutional amendment called the Health Care Freedom Amendment. And that was to say that no citizen of the state of Ohio can have forced upon them the requirement to have to buy insurance of any certain type, quality, or amount by any level of government, whether it be state, local, state, or federal. Now, that's wonderful, Charles, and we can see that working great. But there's only one little problem now. Now, you and I both, and we've argued this before on the program, we both know that Obamacare, or the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, is not constitutionally warranted. There's no provision in the Constitution to allow the federal government to involve themselves in health care decisions of individual citizens. However, Chief Justice John Roberts and a majority of the United States Supreme Court, when brought before them a challenge to Obamacare, and as our listeners who've been with us well know, we've talked about this on the program before, that the court, under Chief Justice Roberts' direction, found that if you considered the act and its penalties a tax, then they found constitutional warrant for it under the taxing powers of Congress in Article 1, Section 8. Now, what that does, Chuck, and this is something that stronger legal minds than me are going to have to come figure out, is that if it's pushed for Obamacare and setting up exchanges and forcing individual citizens to have to pay or businesses to have to pay certain rates that are set by the federal government, if we try to use that constitutional provision in Ohio Constitution, I can see the first line of attack by the Department of Justice attorneys is they're going to say Article 6, the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, which says that this Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof are supreme to any state constitution or laws. Now, since they have a court ruling by John Roberts on their side saying as long as you call it a tax, it's constitutional, they're going to be able to argue an Article 6 supremacy trump to Ohio's Health Care Freedom Amendment.
And yeah, Barry, and I've been arguing that you and I have talked about this on a couple of occasions, because believe it or not, folks, we do sit around and talk about this stuff. I know that makes us sound like a couple of geeks, and there's a reason for that, because we're a couple of geeks.
Oh, but we talk about football, too. Come on.
on rare occasions, yeah, we talk about sports. And Barry is an Ohio State fan, and I'm a Michigan State fan, so that thing makes things interesting from time to time, especially in basketball, because Michigan State's a really good team in basketball.
Yeah, well, so is Ohio State this year.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be a good rivalry this year. In any case, yeah, Article 6 is going to be the stickler. It's the Supremacy Clause. And just for the heck of it, let's pull it up. We'll read it. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. and judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. That last clause is very important, anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. However, the part, Barry, that makes this not a good argument for them, if people understood how the Constitution works, is the opening part.
That's exactly right.
This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof. In other words, the laws to be made by the federal government can only relate back to the enumerated powers.
That's correct.
In other words, powers that are directly delegated by the states to the federal government. And that is in Article 1, Section 8. And we're not going to sit here and read through Article 1, Section 8 for you. You can do that. And in fact, if you don't have a copy of the Constitution,
send us an email. We'll send you one.
Send us an email. We'll send you both an electronic copy and we'll send you a little Citizens Rulebook.
A pocket copy of the Constitution. You can carry around with you.
That has the Declaration of Independence in it as well. Okay. But basically, you go through Article 1, Section 8, and where is anything that has anything to do with the federal government having the right to have any authority whatsoever on health care?
Okay. Now, Chuck, just for our listeners' understanding, there are 18 specific enumerated clause powers that are listed in Article 1, Section 8, that says that this is the things that the Congress can do and can pass a law on. Healthcare is not among them. But if you remember what I said, in our post-constitutional malaise culture, the Supreme Court has ruled that as long as you call whatever the federal government imposes through Health and Human Services on the states through the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, a tax, then according to the court's interpretation, it falls under the taxing power in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress has the right to declare a tax. Well, that creates an entirely different set of problems for those trying to defend Obamacare, because as the congressional record will clearly show, this piece of legislation, which, if it's a tax, means it's an appropriation, and all appropriations are to start in one chamber and one chamber only of the Congress, and that's the United States House of Representatives. However, this piece of legislation, which, according to John Roberts' interesting legal logic, is a tax, therefore an appropriation, it began in the United States Senate. And therefore, a new argument has been put forth toward the courts by a number of groups to say that the Obamacare is unconstitutional and therefore null and void. There's nullification for you. Because if, per se, as John Roberts wants us to believe, it is an appropriation because it's a tax, which makes it constitutional under Article 1, Section 8, then it's an appropriations bill, which makes it unconstitutional because it was originated in the wrong chamber.
That's right. Money bills have to start in the House.
All bills for raising revenues must begin in the House of Representatives. That's Article 1. And so you've got a situation where no matter the arguments that they use, but the big point is because many people, including both attorneys general, and judges of the various courts all the way, and I would guess say up including the Supreme Court, choose not to read the Constitution from its original intent perspective and in context of the rest of the document, and also in context of the notes of the convention in which the Constitution was written, we have the quick knee-jerk reaction that, well, since we've called it constitutional as a tax, therefore the supremacy clause upholds, and so you're other challenge on how it originated is moot. And I can see that coming.
Oh, yeah, a mile away. Barry, that's the beauty. And folks, if you want to be able to do this kind of an analysis on the Constitution, you really should take one of our Institute on the Constitution classes. It's well worth the money. I realize you may not have $60 in your pocket, but think about it this way. It's a 12-week class, costs you $5 a week. I mean, you cannot beat that. And when you walk away from that class, you will walk away with a knowledge of the Constitution you never thought possible. It's really far more simple than you think. Are there complex places in it? I won't kid you.
Oh, yes.
But that's why we're here. We're here to help you. And in fact, we want you not only to learn it, we want you to learn it to the point where you can learn how to teach it.
And we would love for you to contact us, send us an email through our website at principalpolicy.com, and let us know where you live, and if you can gather a group of like-minded folks who would like to take the class, we'd be more than happy to try to launch a class in your area. We have classes going. You know, Chuck and I personally do classes stretching all the way from central Ohio down to southeastern Ohio, but then we've also got about 15 to 20 different classes that are starting almost every quarter in the southwestern part of the state, from Dayton to Cincinnati, up toward Washington Courthouse, and all those other areas. I'll personally go as far here. I can go down all the way to South Point, and I'll come all the way as far north as Chuck wants to go up and teach. Sometimes we tag team teach. But the thing is, we would love to get in front of your group and help you to understand the history and the importance of this document that we've been given, understand how to look at it, how to utilize it to as a tool to fight back against a culture that is definitely post-constitutional. Because things like these secession petitions, ladies and gentlemen, sound very good on their face. They're very enticing. They're very appealing. But they're very much the wrong way to handle the issue if you want to have an effective response.
Absolutely, Barry. And it's really not that hard. Once you learn how the thing works, how the mechanics work, it's really not that hard to do this kind of an analysis. Now, sure, you're going to run into rough spots. A lot of times the way the federal and the state governments are supposed to interact becomes a rough spot because it doesn't work the way it's supposed to anymore. That's one of the really hard things to get people to understand. They think it's been like this through the entire republic. Folks, some of these problems only aren't even 100 years old yet, specifically the problem with the Senate. You know, the Senate used to be chosen exclusively by the state legislatures because senators were the legislature's representatives in the federal government. It's what truly made the federal government federal. Well, that got wiped out with the progressives. Thank you very much, progressives. In the late 1890s, early 1900s, who got the 16th Amendment passed, because we just had to have popular election of senators. So what we ended up with was a super Congress, a super House of Representatives, where we have, instead of having a number of people distributed by population, we have two super legislators who have a six-year term, meaning that by the end of that 6 years, only a very few people remember what that person did during their first 2 years. Now, the reason that the House of Representatives has a two-year term is because people's memories are short. The founding fathers only wanted those people to be able to make mistakes for 2 years before you got the chance to toss them out. The fact that we don't toss them now is not the fault of the founders or the design.
Right.
It's the fault of the voters. And I keep hearing things about term limits. I always laugh. I always tell people there are already term limits. 2 years for Congress, 6 years for the Senate, and 4 years for the president. If you don't like them, throw them out. And what I always get is, but everybody else keeps voting them in. How hard are you working to get them out? How hard are you working to get a replacement for them? And that comes full circle around to some of the stuff we've been saying all week this week. The fact is that people get lazy about who's serving them in Congress and who's serving them in the Senate, who's serving them in the White House, who's serving them in the State House, who's serving in the governor's office. They get lazy about that.
Yes, they
do. Let George do it. I have a close friend at my church. In fact, Barry, I'm about to be ordained as an elder in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and someone who will soon be my fellow elder is from Germany. And he and I were discussing one day the different ways that Germans think about their government versus the way Americans think about their government. And he said that the attitude in Germany is that you elect these people to do a job and then you back away and let them do the job. And he said, in America, it seems like everybody wants to be involved in the political process. And I kind of laughed about that. And I go, well, the German way is becoming far more prevalent than you think it is. But you're right. Americans who are truly active in this kind of thing really do want to interact with their legislators, sometimes far more often than the legislators want to have to interact with us. And he really kind of didn't understand why, and I tried to explain it, and it's a little difficult because there is a cultural gap, but nonetheless, I think I was able to get the idea across that we believe in truly representational government. In order for to have representational government, you have to have communications with the person who is representing you.
This is true.
Barry, this is why. Now, if you think about this, the way God designed government to work is representational. I had a recent discussion with someone. We're kind of going far afield from the thing, but it all ties in. I had a recent discussion with someone who basically we were talking about the law in the Old Testament and how, in fact, that all came preformed and nobody had to do anything. And I said, well, that's nonsense. Of course, there's a legislature in the Old Testament. And they said, how can you say that? And I said, have you ever seen the phrase, the whole congregation said amen, or the whole congregation went along with it, or the whole congregation did this, or the whole assembly? And they always say yes. Okay, do you really think that 5 million people were there?
No, of course not.
This was a representative. This was a federally representative body.
It absolutely was.
These were elected representatives, and everybody always says, well, where's election? And they mean electoral-type election, not salvation-type election. They said, where's election in the Old Testament? I go, it's easy. Deuteronomy 1.
Exactly.
If you look at Exodus 18, Exodus 18 lays out the criteria for choosing civil leaders. It's not ecclesiastical. It's civil. Deuteronomy 1. Is where Moses says, I gave you the criteria, and you chose the representatives who would come do this job for you. It's a very obscure passage. Almost nobody ever catches it. I remember the first time I read it, I went, oh my gosh, this is an election.
Exactly.
And I read it. Maybe I'm wrong. So I consulted a couple of commentaries.
Commentaries, yes, of course.
Sure enough. They agreed. Yeah, this is Moses basically laid the criteria out and left it up to the heads of the tribes and the families to figure out who was going to represent them in this judgeship. And the judgeship basically turned out to be the guys who sit in the gate and act as the legislature. Well, that's who became the assembly or the congregation. So when you hear that the entire congregation or assembly said amen or did this or did that, it's not 5 million Hebrews. It's a representative body that represents those Hebrews. And that's what a lot of people miss. So not only is our federal government, you know, here in the United States, it's very built very much on that model, that representative model. And, you know, God has built a number of his governments. Family government works this way. The father is the federal head. Civil government, it is supposed to be representational. Democracy is not a good thing. In fact, if you read throughout the Old Testament, democracy is not shown to be a good thing. It's shown to be a bad thing. And the same thing with church government. Personally, you know, there's no mandate, but it sure looks like a representational government through an eldership to me. I've served in different kind of church government, and frankly, this was the one that makes the most sense to me. The people choose the elders from among the congregation who then act as servants and representatives to them. to the different church bodies and, of course, to Christ. And again, the father in family government serves as the representative head of his family, both to Christ and then from Christ back to the family. So that's why it's the father's duty. So we've gone a little far afield on that, but that's the way this works, Barry. And the fact is that people don't seem to understand that. They're looking for a top-down system, when in fact, the way the model is designed to work is bottom-up.
Absolutely.
So guess what? We're out of time.
No doubt.
So join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.